Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture. I'm here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana right now with Dr. Wade Warren, a professor of biology at Louisiana College. And we are here in Baton Rouge because there's a hearing before the Louisiana House Committee on Education for the Academic Freedom Bill that has been submitted here into the Louisiana State Legislature. I'm here with Dr. Warren, who came here to testify in favor of the bill, and really appreciate your willingness to do a podcast with us here, Dr. Warren.
Well, thank you, Casey. I'm glad to be here supporting the bill.
Well, could you first tell our listeners just a little bit about your own background as a scientist and what some of the research you've done has been about?
Sure. I did my doctoral work at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, where I developed a keen interest in neuroscience, and did most of the research that I've done has been in that area with a lot of emphasis in the study of biological clocks and circadian rhythms. So I've done a lot of work on the suprachiasmatic nucleus and done a lot of pineolectomy surgeries on rats and birds and chickens. And
now, I bet that most of our listeners don't know what a pineolectomy surgery is, and including me. So could you explain what is a pineolectomy surgery?
Sure. Sort of the central thinking around circadian rhythms is a lot of the research is focused in really two areas. One is a structure in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is widely recognized as the biological clock in mammals. But the pineal gland, which is a gland that sits just underneath the cerebrum, the big part in the front part of your brain, between the cerebrum and the cerebellum, the pineal gland secretes a hormone called melatonin, and that hormone actually binds to cells in the suprachiasmatic nucleus and does influence biological timing. And so my research really was focused on learning about the interaction between that hormone and the biological clock in mammals. And we used Long-Evans rats as a model.
So when you say biological clock, you're not talking about a woman needs to have children before a certain age. You're talking about the 24-hour cycle, day and night cycle, and when do we fall asleep? When do you get hungry? Those sorts of things. Is that basically correct?
That's exactly right. So we did experiments, for example, like where we would have a group of animals where we would do a surgery and remove the pineal gland and then watch their rhythmic behavior to see how they predict time. And
Take out their chronometer and see what they do.
Well, the rat pineal gland is not the clock. It influences the clock. It always pleases me to see news articles talking about melatonin helping with jet lag and that sort of thing. That all sort of comes out of that kind of research.
So what happens to a rat that's had these terrible surgeries you're doing to them to mess up their clocks?
It started by with the observation that nothing happens when you remove a pineal gland out of a rat. And so we had to really work hard to discover what melatonin was doing in the biological clock. And some of that research is still, of course, ongoing. But
You don't consider yourself a sadistic person or anything like that.
I do not.
Okay.
I have a keen interest in biological clocks.
This is purely for scientific interest.
Purely for scientific interest.
Not to make the lives of rats miserable. That's okay. I've known many biologists like you. That's okay. Now, I have another quick question. I mean, are mammals the only taxa that have biological clocks? I mean, I would assume that insects or fish. I mean, do other species have them as well?
Everything from blue-green algae to humans has a biological clock. And, of course, much of the molecular work in biological clocks started in Drosophila. And so one of my graduate advisors at Texas A&M, Dr. Paul Hardin, was an expert in Drosophila circadian rhythms. And so, absolutely, biological clocks are in all living things, essentially.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that
when I say clock, it should be pointed out that this is the organism's ability to predict time in the absence of timing cues. So we take them out of a light-dark cycle. We take them out of any kind of timing cue they have, and they continue to predict time.
Wow. Now, I'll just share with you, I don't understand this. My mother and I both have an uncanny ability. I mean, if you tell us to wake up at 4:56 tomorrow morning, I just might wake up right around that time. Maybe might be 4:54. It might be 4:58. And it's not always perfect, but, you know, I don't understand how this works.
I've had a lot of people tell me that sort of thing. I've experienced it myself. There's not a really hard and fast neuroanatomical way to explain why that is, but certainly you have access to time information.
Okay,
and so it's a phenomenon that makes it interesting. When I'm going to talk to a group of non-science people, I often start with that story. You know that you have a biological clock. You tell yourself, tomorrow morning I have to get up at 6 to make
that's
it
right.
to work.
That's
and so,
right.
And you wake up at 5:59.
Yep, yep.
So it helps people realize that they do, in fact, have a clock.
I remember when I was taking the bar exam, I accidentally set my alarm for p.m. rather than a.m., but I still woke up right at the right time. So
Not many people have the opportunity to live in an underground bunker where they don't have timing cues, where they can actually see that they have a clock running.
Did you have that opportunity, or
I did not.
Okay.
But this is where we get our information, where the information started about humans having clocks. You have to take away their social cues. You have to take away any kind of information they're getting from the outside world, especially sunlight or access to a light-dark cycle.
Wow. This is very, very fascinating. I would love to go on and on about this, but let's talk a little bit about the reason that we're here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana right now. And I understand that you, as a professor of biology and as a professional biologist, you are a skeptic of Darwinian evolution. And I was hoping you can maybe give our listeners just some of the reasons why you hold that position.
Well, I don't really think that the best evidence that we have from science ultimately supports the Darwinian model. It's clear to me every semester, even when I teach my freshman biology classes, as I go through teaching the principles of evolution to them in a stepwise fashion, that even kids who are 17 and 18 years old very quickly begin to see weaknesses in the explanatory power of the current synthesis of evolution.
Wow. So you
asked me why I'm skeptical, and so I think the basic answer to that question is, at all levels of looking for explanations from the origin of life to the diversity of species to the physiology of the cell, it seems to me that the Darwinian model just does not fit the evidence.
Now, we often hear, Dr. Warren, that Darwinists will say things like, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And they will say that you need evolution to understand anything that's going on in biology. Has that been your experience in your research with circadian rhythms? Do you need Darwinian evolution to research and understand and explain circadian rhythms?
Well, it's an interesting question. And a sort of similar question was asked of me, and has been asked of me several times, and I've been asked by individuals sort of first come to some basic understanding about biological clocks, the simple question, why do we have biological clocks? And sort of gets at the heart of what you're asking there, is why would organisms, we live on a planet that oscillates on a 24-hour cycle, what would be the adaptive significance of having a clock? And sure, there are certainly speculative answers that can get to that for reasons for clocks. But certainly, in my opinion, an evolutionary model is not required for discovery in the study of biological clocks. None of the proposals that I have written, none of the papers that I have published on biological clocks have used as their foundation an evolutionary model.
Okay.
So I would say the answer to your question in a very wordy fashion is no, it's not required. I would say that the lab that I worked in at Texas A&M, the principal investigator there wrote a grant proposal that funded a large research project that was intended to explore the evolutionary relationships in the binding sites of melatonin in the brains of many different species of animals. And I found it interesting at the end of that study, and I'm not going to bore you with it, but at the end of that study, the evolutionary model that was used to propose what might be found in that study certainly did not bear out in the evidence.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so, but we, you know, when the paper was published, mm-hmm. which I was not an author on, that was not highlighted in the paper, that the evidence that was shown with the binding sites of melatonin in all these different species did not support this sort of gradualistic thinking.
Wow.
And how those binding sites may have appeared.
Wow.
In the various systems. So
that's very interesting. Yeah. Well, this is a good segue into the next question I wanted to ask you about. Is there within the academic community a bias towards evolution? Maybe even you might say a bias towards trying to put on the best show possible for evolution and trying to squelch the centers of Darwinian evolution. In your experience, obviously, being in academia, did you ever see that there was intolerance or hostility towards those who would openly express scientific doubts about Darwinism?
Yes, I did have an experience as a graduate student. No experience like that as a postdoctoral fellow or as a faculty member. But as a graduate student, while teaching laboratory sections at Texas A&M, the course director had scheduled the labs such that the last week of the semester was a free lab period. I thought that would be an interesting time, an interesting opportunity for these undergraduate students. That I was a very eager graduate student. I wanted to talk philosophy of science with them and learning the scientific process and being interested in biological clocks and neuroscience was all so fresh and new in my mind at that time. And so I thought, this would be a great opportunity to get these kids to come this last week of the semester, and we can have some sort of open forum debate and talk about different ideas in the philosophy of science, because I know what's going on in the lecture sections is a pure Darwinist philosophy of science presentation without clear explanations as to as to any sort of dissenting views. So I suggested this. I did not mention anything to those kids about God or religion.
Sure.
Let's have an open discussion about the validity of evolutionary thinking. Well, evidently there were kids in that room who were not pleased with that suggestion. And the next morning, the course director called me into her office. We had a short conversation in which she asked me to tell her the facts about what had happened. And I told her just as I've told you, and then she directed me on to the dean of the college.
Oh my goodness.
Who had already been notified. I sat down in his office very intimidated.
Oh yeah.
He's in his big leather chair. I'm sitting in the couch across the desk, and he looks across at me as if to verify the facts of what had happened. And I explained to him in a very apologetic way. I was scared already.
Oh, my goodness, sure.
And so he said, well, let me tell you what's going to happen, Mr. Warren. You're going to cancel that meeting, and I'm not going to hear any more of this.
Wow.
And like a good trooper, that's exactly what I did.
Well, wow.
You know, I felt like the students were cheated out of a good educational experience.
Wow.
But it was very educational for me.
Wow. Yeah. That's an amazing story. Unfortunately, not a very uncommon one, but this is truly a situation where scientific inquiry was shut down. You were trying to educate your students about problems of evolution, or even just let them ask the questions. You weren't even necessarily trying to push them in a direction, just provide a forum where the questions could be asked, and they shut you down.
Yeah, which is exactly why I consider it such a privilege to be here in Baton Rouge, being a part of this, supporting Senate Bill 733 tomorrow.
Wow. And so why do you support this bill, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, a bunch of different reasons. I guess the most important one is I sure would like for my kids to have the opportunity, being in the public schools here in Louisiana, to have science teachers, especially those who really love science and really love thinking, to be able to get the best education they can.
Wow.
And if those science teachers have the freedom to ask questions without fear of the repercussions of questioning Darwinian evolution, then they're going to get a better education.
Mm. Wow. No doubt about it. Dr. Wade Warren, we really appreciate your time being with us on the show today. If I could throw one last question at you here. You obviously were a grad student at one time and also an undergraduate student, I'm sure, studying science. If you had any advice to students today who are in a position you were in, you know, what advice would you give them? What would you tell them if they are in an environment where they are not free to express doubts about Darwinian evolution, or they don't know if they do express those doubts, you know, what might happen to them? They have no knowledge of what could be the repercussions. What advice would you give students in that situation today?
Well, it's going to be very difficult, the way graduate education is done today in this country, to find a place where you can do the kind of scientific research that you love and are interested in without having to toe the line at some level. Yeah. I would encourage a young person to learn to be a good scientist and to be savvy about the way they challenge the scientific establishment. I can see sort of from my own experience that if I had decided that I was going to be a crusader in the anti-Darwinian movement, if you will, as a graduate student at Texas A&M, I probably would not have completed a doctoral degree.
Wow.
So I know that's not very encouraging, but, you know, the state of science today is very difficult for an individual who does not follow the gospel of Darwin.
Wow. Well, Dr. Wade Warren, I think that is good advice for students. We've heard similar advice from other scientists who have had experiences like you to tell students to be very careful about what they say, and, you know, but at the same time to be thinking for themselves and not to stop thinking and not to stop pursuing excellence and following the evidence, you know, wherever they think it should be followed. So this is good advice, and we appreciate your time very much here. Thank you.
Thank you, Casey. Yeah.
Well, this is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Thank you for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.